Good evening. It is Thursday, May 9th, and it's about 9:03 p.m. Eastern Time. This is the NLA discussion group call. Everybody speaks for themselves, not necessarily the NLA, may or may not be, but they definitely speak for themselves. This is a free and open forum, and everyone can participate. It's kind of free flow, and the subject is whatever you, the participant, decide it should be. Don't be afraid. We always run out of time at the end, and we always waste a lot of time because people are afraid to get on there. So I hope somebody speaks up soon. And I'm going to stop this clock and restart it. And if I get more than about a minute of silence, we'll just close the call off. So with that, without further ado, this is the discussion group call. And everyone's welcome to go. You all have the floor. Thank you.
Okay, this evening we are fortunate in that we have Elaine Willman with us. She's the author of Slumbering Thunder, a primer for confronting the spread of federal Indian policy and tribalism overwhelming America. And she's going to talk to us this evening on the Constitution and federal Indian policy. So go ahead, Elaine, it's all yours.
Thank you. Am I speaking with Jan? Is that you,
yep.
Jan?
This is Jan, yes.
This is going to be interesting because I'm flying blind here. I haven't met all the folks on the call. And I'm not sure who lives where in terms of anyone that may live near Indian reservations or not. So I'm going to do a couple of things. And I encourage, for those on the call, I encourage interrupting me and asking questions. That's how we learn. And I love good conversation. So please don't hesitate to jump in and interrupt me. But what I'm going to attempt to do is first give you a little quickie background on where I'm coming from. My professional life was that as an administrator, community development director, economic development director, planner in small cities in Southern California, Washington State, over in Wisconsin. I've always worked with small local governments because I love the fact that a citizen can walk in and, you know, raise his voice and be heard. That's the best level of our country's government is in local communities. So that's been my career. And I'm also Cherokee, and my husband is Shoshone. And so one of my jobs was up on the Yakima Reservation in the middle of Washington State. It's huge, and it has four towns on it, and I was community development director there and excited to go and live on a real reservation. Since that point in time, I've lived on three Indian reservations for the last 30 years. That was my awakening to federal Indian policy. I call federal Indian policy the best-kept secret and a growing non-republic form of government spreading across our states, 38 of them, like a big hippopotamus sitting on our country. And I'll explain some of that later. But for now, I want to just kind of quickly mention that you know, as I said, I'm Cherokee, and my family had told me for years and years that I was French and Indian, and I have the enrollment numbers of my mother and grandmother, and so I've happily said on videos and talks across the country that I'm Cherokee. Then along comes Elizabeth Warren, who says she's Cherokee, and I thought, you know, maybe I better validate my ancestry a little more. So I sent off for my DNA, and sure enough, I'm 30% Cherokee and 24% Irish and 0% French. My surname, my maiden name is DeVary. It's French. But I'm no French. I'm an Irish Indian. In any event, that's just a little background of who I am. I was born during World War II, so you know that I'm older than dirt. But I also was educated in this country at a time period when our schools were teaching American history, government, social sciences, I got a good K through 12, and I've actually got 96 credits for the doctoral. I got a good education because of my age and stage, and that's one of the biggest problems we have now is the lack of a good education. So what I'd like to do next is just whip through. This is going to be quick. We all are familiar with some of these dates and not so familiar with others. We certainly know 1776 was our Declaration of Independence. We also know that 1789 was the adoption of our Constitution. And this is the thing about federal Indian policy. All of you are very knowledgeable. I know that you're pretty expert in the Constitution. But there is nothing within the four corners of our Constitution. There is no text. There's nothing within the Federalist Papers supporting and further educating us on the Constitution. There is nothing in our Constitution where the framers contemplated non-republic forms of government within states. There is nothing that justifies federal Indian policy in the Constitution. All of it is absolutely unconstitutional. Excuse me. And that is profound, considering the decisions made by Congress over the years, expanding tribal governments and Indian reservations, sometimes contracting. The Congress didn't really know what to do with the Indians in the early 1800s and some of the 1900s. But Congress has assumed, and they've been supported by shady attorneys and demanding tribal leaders and bureaucrats growing their agencies, they've been persuaded to continue this process of creating non-republic forms of government called tribal governments across the country. In 1830, the eastern side of the country was getting fairly well settled, and there were conflicts with President Jackson and some others who encouraged the Indians to be moved in 1830 by the Indian Removal Act west of the Mississippi. And the 1830 period, from 1830 to the 1870s, the federal government entered into treaties and with many of the tribes, relocating them, giving them land, and setting up tribal governments and Indian reservations throughout the country. The interesting piece, just to give a little context to this, most of the treaties with Indian tribes were executed in 1855, the mid-1850s. And so I'd like all of you listening to think of 1855 in the United States and what was happening and who was getting what. 1855 was 5 years before the Civil War. And in 1855, from 1830 through 1855, Horace Greeley and Congress and the feds were saying, go west, young man. We'd already purchased the Louisiana Purchase. We had most of the territories that are now the continental United States. And it was really important to encourage folks to go west. Go west, young man. So young man put his little stuff in his wagon and went west. And he was told if he found a piece of ground and improved it for 5 years, he could buy it at a low homesteaded rate. So young man went west. He was given nothing. He was not given 10 cents. But young man goes west. He finds a piece of ground, he builds his home, and neighbors come up, and they find a piece of ground and build their home, and then they build the school, and then they build a church, and then they build a store. And the West started exploding, and not long after, we have Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles. Young man truly settled the West and was given nothing for that effort. It was all individual, entrepreneurial, American spirit settling the country. That was in the 1855. In 1855, tribal governments were given land. They were given money, resources. they were paid for the land. The treaties were sales contracts. You hear very often, oh, you stole our land. We were here first. Every one of those treaties had a big money bill attached to it, buying the land from the Indians and giving it to them and giving them beneficial use and occupancy, giving them food, blacksmith, doctors, schools every year. So Native Americans in the 1850s and earlier were always given resources, and they still have amazing resources. A young man settled the West for nothing from the feds. Also in 1855, prior to Harriet Beecher Stowe's book of 1857, Uncle Tom's Cabin, the American people were considering black Americans as cattle, as slaves. They were being bought and sold. So when we look at the United States that has done many things right and many things wrong, the ones that were getting the resources were certainly not the blacks, certainly not the settlers, and only the Indians. And that's kind of a context that I think we should consider, because tribal governments continually, with their propaganda that goes on today, continually demand more and more and more. And there's never been a point where, even with tax-exempt gaming, even with all of their basic needs, housing, health, education, courts, cultural resources, even with all basic needs covered every single year, it's not enough because we sold their land. And yet we have an entire mixed population that has built this country because it's the right thing to do, and not with any federal resources. So it's kind of questionable why the Native Americans say that they're so mistreated. Certainly we're not as mistreated as the blacks or even the settlers. That's just my perspective. Congress tried to, while settling the West, in 1871 they ended the treaty making, and all those treaties were only supposed to be for about 25 years. Congress figured, and the federal agencies figured, that two generations of Native Americans, it would take about two generations for Native Americans to become fully assimilated and citizens of the country along with the rest of us. So the treaties were intended to be 25 years. And by 1871, Congress ended all treaty making. And then a little later on, Congress opened up those reservations. Congress opened up the reservations with the Dawes Act of 1887. To homesteaders. And the Dawes Act was intended to end tribal governments and end reservations and create citizens out of Indians given individual land, allotments. So the Dawes Act went into play, and a lot of the reservations were opened wide. And all the enrolled tribal members received a parcel of land, either 40 or 160, depending on the size of their family. They were given a patent to their land with a water right attached to it, and they were made citizens of their state. And so the reservation system was going away. And by 1924, we got the Snyder Act that made all American Indians full citizens, just like you and me, full citizens by 1924. Then we got another big pendulum swing. And 10 years later, in 1934, there was a fellow by the name of John Collier, who was an avowed communist, wrote several books on communists, and happened to become the Commissioner of Indian Affairs in the Department of Interior in 1934. And it was his belief that the Indians were not really good at owning land. They were losing their culture, and they needed to live communally and culturally. And life was not working for them. And they were, he said, they were, assimilation was just decimating Native Americans. It was not, but that was his position. And he and a young assistant attorney by the name of Felix Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, his attorney assistant, were very persuasive of Congress to pass the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. And that act was intended to reorganize the existing federal tribes then, only the existing federal tribes then, into separate tribal governments, non-republican form. They were given a constitution, They had to walk, if they wanted to become an Indian Reorganization Act, they had to walk away from their treaties and follow a constitution. Their members voted to either remain a treaty tribe or become an IRA, Indian Reorganization Act tribe. And most of the tribes became IRA tribes because there were far more benefits. While they were treaty tribes, they did not control their land. They had beneficial use and occupancy only. They had no authority over the land. Only the Bureau of Indian Affairs did. But as Indian Reorganization Act tribe, they had authority over their federal trust lands and Indian land and jurisdiction, land jurisdiction. And that was very attractive to them. So that should have affected about 65 to 75 tribes. But as things go today in 2019, we currently have 573 tribal governments and reservations throughout the United States. About 348 of them are in the lower 48, and then there's a couple hundred up in Alaska. But these are tribes that were allowed to become Indian Reorganization Act tribes when the act was specific that only those tribes that existed in 34 were covered. We can fast forward to 1988 when the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act came out. When that act was up for discussion in Congress, I thought the American gaming industry would be furious. Why would they want to compete with tax-exempt tribal casinos? And so, you know, naively, I thought, this is not going to fly. But lo and behold, the American gaming industry, folks like Stations Casinos and MGM Grand and the developers of casinos, they saw a gold mine with the Gaming Act. They fully supported the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. And they went out and solicited tribes, said, we will buy your land. We will build your casino. We will train your staff. We will take a 7-year management contract, and we will get you up and running. The tribal governments didn't spend a dime on these casinos. American gaming industry jumped right in. So prior to 1988, we had what we all knew as destination gaming. I'd have to go to Reno or Vegas or Atlantic City to gamble. Now we have what I call McDonald's for the mob. We have casinos across this country. In 1988, California had 4 tribes and 4 reservations. In 2019, Congress has California has close to 150 tribal governments and about that many or more very lucrative casinos, all tax exempt. And when a tax exempt casino lands in a town, the disposable income goes there. And the retail and restaurant and associated businesses nearby start dwindling. Eventually, the casino will put up a hotel. The casino will put up gas stations. They'll put up dress shops and all kinds of other tribal businesses. And the non-tribal tax-paying businesses are hammered within 5 to 10 miles of every casino. Absolutely hammered. Now, what happens to that loss of taxes? You know, it is shifted to the remaining taxpayer. When the land comes out of the state tax base for tribes, the burden on property tax is shifted, and we pay that. So the American public, even though we don't live near a casino or a tribe or a reservation, we feel it in our states, depending on how many tribes you have in your state. We feel it in the form of business, the economy, the tax that we're all supporting. So am I making sense so far? I'm not hearing anything. Hello?
Yes. Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. So I just kind of wanted to talk big picture about why this federal Indian policy affects every single one of us in this country. So that's kind of the background on the situation today. I would add that 4 out of 5 American Indians long ago left the reservation. There's only about 1.5 million enrolled tribal members across the country in these 573 tribes. The federal government spends more than $30 billion funding these tribal governments' basic services every year. That's our taxpayer dollar. And the tribal governments have all these tax-exempt businesses, which we have to compensate for, too. So it just seems that when all Native Americans were made citizens in 1924, we should all be standing equal with each other, equal opportunity, and these non-republic forms of government should not exist. They certainly should not, according to the Constitution. But what we hear, and we hear a lot of things that are not true, we hear, oh, treaties are the supreme law of the land, treaties. That's 1/3 of the Supremacy Clause. And the founders wrote that Supremacy Clause in the specific order. The Supremacy Clause says this Constitution first, the laws of Congress second, and treaties are the supreme law of the land. But Congress ended treaty making in 1871, and the treaties were really pretty much dead about that time. But ironically, when the big gaming money started rolling in after 1988, all of a sudden the tribes and their attorneys, who will argue anything for a dime, are saying, oh, we have these treaty rights. We have these, and treaty rights have been illegal and inappropriately resurrected. The poster child for the biggest state, the state that is absolutely decimated by this, is Washington State. Washington State, I live out in the middle of nowhere, Montana. You can put 3 Washington states in the state of Montana. And Washington State has 31 tribes. And they absolutely control the legislature in Olympia, the governor's office, the attorney general's office. They control a lot of county commissions. They can run for office in tribal members can become a county commissioner and make decisions in the best interest of the tribe instead of the county. That's happening seriously here in Montana. But the power of a very few American Indians in all these tribes is profound. But the mainstream media will not talk about these things. The propaganda. We have what I call the Indian industry, and it's huge. The Indian industry is the legal profession, very big money for attorneys. Lobbyists. There's one tribe in Alabama that has 30 lobbyists in the halls of Congress every day for this one tribe, the Poarch Creek tribe in Alabama. The attorneys, the lobbyists, the legislators, and here's the real problem we have. Here's the political power that is really on steroids. Right before the Bush-Gore election of 2000, a New York tribe wrote the Federal Election Commission and said, may our tribal government participate financially in elections? And that Federal Election Commission, which is an appointed advisory board, not an elected board, issued an advisory opinion, AO 2000-05, and informed that New York tribe, it was the Oneidas of New York, informed them that, well, you're a government for purposes of receiving subsidies and governance, but you're a person for purposes of elections, so yes, you may contribute financially to in our elections, campaign contributions and such. Now, our city, county, state, federal governments may not do so. None of our republic form of governing systems may participate financially in elections. But 573 tribal governments do extensively. and most of them are very wealthy gaming tribes, so they pour money into both political parties, but they specifically pour money into governor's campaigns, Senate campaigns, state legislator campaigns. And those are the fellows and gals that become what I call the coin-operated elected officials. Once they're elected and they've been heavily funded by an Indian tribe, when they get into their duties, if they say no or do not follow through, they're replaced. They're taken out by an elected official that will. And so this is the way you ramp up the political power of about 1.5 million Indians to control your state legislature and your governor's office and whatnot. And that's Washington State. That's also Montana. As big as Montana is, it only has 7 tribes. But these tribes control the elections and control the legislators and the governor. And one of the problems I see is that the American citizen, and I'm speaking kind of broadly here, but the American citizen is raised fundamentally to be a kind, understanding, and tolerant person. And we certainly don't want to be called bad names. And we've certainly been vastly educated as to how bad we treated the poor Indians. We stole their land. And so we have a false guilt. We've all walked around for decades with this false guilt that has been slathered on us with the propagandists, the lobbyists, the tribal leaders. I'm not speaking of the tribal families that live on these reservations. They're as clueless and uninformed and mistreated as anybody I know. But I am speaking of the tribal leaders of these governments, the attorneys, the legislators, the lobbyists. It's a whole industry, and the gaming industry. This is enormous money and political power and influence over our governments, whether it's federal, state, or local. Enormous. But none of us, you know, when I was down in Southern California in the 80s, I had no clue that this stuff was going on. It wasn't until I was working and living on the first reservation that my lights came on. And so that's kind of an overview of what's going on. Now, there's one new piece, thanks to the former administration, not the current one, thank God, but the previous administration, and even Beth Clinton and the Bushes, the catering to tribal governments and the growth of gaming and politics and tribal influence in politics was so huge in the former administration. President Obama had a great thought that this just tears me up to think about it. But he got the idea that our national power grid, our dams, our electric systems, and our national power grid would be good economic development for tribal governments. And he encouraged and persuaded Congress to pass the Indian Energy Policy Act. And he threw billions of dollars out to tribal governments to acquire major dams, major power facilities. Now, mind you, a tribal government has a duty to its enrolled members only and its own federal trust land. It has no duty to you or me or a customer base of a major dam or power facility. But Obama thought it was a swell idea to fund tribes to acquire major components of our national power grid. Here on the Flathead where I live, this tribe now owns the big Kerr Dam. The problem with this, I have to backtrack to 1904 for just a minute. When the West was being settled in 1904, a Secretary of Interior then, Alfred B. Fall, best known for the Teapot Dome scandal and the only cabinet member to be impeached, Alfred B. Fall put a directive out because the new western states needed help getting water on the arid lands and getting the electrical grid going in the new states. Fall put out a directive that all major dams and power facilities were to be located on or near Indian reservations. That was the way the federal government could keep its thumb
on the power in the country, in the western states, by requiring that all the dams, think of Hoover Dam, think of Grand Coulee Dam, think of any of the major dams out in the western states, and they're all on or near Indian reservations. So then we have Obama saying, well, let's let the tribes acquire these dams, and they're being acquired. And the tribe has no duty to the customer base. And the tribe is keeping the revenue from these power dams. What do you think that's doing to our electric and utility bills? And what do you think that's doing to the availability of irrigation waters for farmers and cattlemen in the western states? So that was one thing Obama did. And then 2 years later in 2014, under Obama, Congress passed the HEARTH Act, H-E-A-R-T-H. And that's a major federal appropriations bill for funding all things tribal. But within it, Obama communicated that there's an awful lot of commonalities between American Native Americans and some of our Middle Eastern cultures, that they live communally, they have a lot in common, and it would be a good idea to allow tribal governments to execute long-term leases for up to 75 years on their Indian trust lands when those state or county eyes are possible, to engage in economic development, quote-unquote, with Middle Eastern countries. So now we have tribes. The country of Turkey has targeted 17 tribes in the country to do economic development with them on the Indian lands. And the 17 tribes and reservations that Turkey has identified happen to be major uranium resources on the land. Here on the Flathead, this tribe has been working with Saudi Arabia for some years and Turkey, and they send their tribal students over to Turkey, and Turkey students come over here, and we're doing this little matchmaking between Middle Eastern countries and Indian reservations that are located right next to our major dams and power supplies. That, in my mind, is a national security risk of major proportions, major, and no one's talking about it. And tribal governments have no duty to do public notices, public hearings, let you know what they're doing whatsoever. But this is going on. So this is the main reason I have to make clear separations for respect for my own ancestry and my affection for, as I said, I've lived on the Yakima, the Oneida Reservation in Wisconsin, and now the Flathead here in Montana. Most of my friends are tribal families. I'm just very comfortable with that. My husband is Shoshone. He's a descendant of Sacagawea. I make clear separations between my affection and respect for my culture and ancestry that is very separate from these government decisions that are polka-dotting this United States with very risky areas. And so that's kind of a background at a national level. Does anybody have any questions or comments yet? Come on. Anybody listening?
Most people are muted, so if they wanted to talk, they'd unmute it and ask your question, so I think you're free to go on.
Okay. Well, the next part is I want to give tips to just the callers, and they need to speak with their family members and whatnot. I don't know if any of you live near an Indian reservation or if when you're on vacation, you're driving through an Indian reservation, but there are some things that the American citizen needs to know when traveling or entering a reservation or a tribal facility of any kind, tribal casinos as well. And that is, tribal governments have no authority whatsoever. Their only authority is over their enrolled tribal members. But they will frequently exert authority over non-tribal members who don't know better. And they'll bring them into tribal court, and which they should never do. A non-tribal person should never bodily walk into the tribal court. But what I'm saying is there's an abuse of that. If we don't know better, and we're raised to respect authority, and some tribal officer says, I'm going to write you up for this, you're coming into tribal court, we go. And then we've consented to be governed. And so what the American public needs to be keenly aware of is that tribal governments have no authority over the American public, only their enrolled members. If a tribal officer pulls me over, if I've been speeding or doing something goofy on a public road, and by the way, all roads on Indian reservations are public roads. Tribal governments don't have the enforcement on the roads. Your state and county and city law enforcement do. A tribal officer could pull me over if I'm on a public road within an Indian reservation. He could stop me, and I would ask him to call an officer of my government, period. He could stop and detain me and call from an officer of my government, because I will not and I should not honor a tribal citation or go into tribal court. I have no due process, no rights, no nothing if I consent to be governed, and they have no duty to me. So that's one of the things that occasionally citizens will get kind of tangled up with these things because they don't know different. I was recently giving a talk in Yakima, Washington, and one of the ladies there cautioned that we should never hand our driver's license to a tribal police officer. Simply and politely ask for an officer of your government and just wait. Don't get out of the car, just wait. That's just a little tip. Another little tip is if you're in a tribal casino or tribal restaurant or tribal parking lot or something goes wrong, your car gets vandalized or you get food poisoning in the restaurant or swindled in the casino, they can't be sued. You have no recourse, none whatsoever. State law does not apply. And so the American public that is frequenting these casinos is doing so at their own risk. If anything goes wrong, it's too bad. Tribal governments that have sovereign immunity. So that's another little thing to tuck in the back of your thinking caps, I guess. There's many other things, but I'm not sure how deep to go or how far to go or what to do next. I'd certainly welcome some feedback from you guys. It would give me a sense of what might help. How about that? Can somebody unmute and ask me a question?
Is this a federal zone you're talking about that we don't have any rights in?
We don't have any rights on federal Indian trust land, which is the lands that casinos are on, the lands that tribal businesses are on, their headquarters, their housing. There's two kinds of lands in our state. There's federal Indian trust land, for which the tribal government and their law enforcement has full authority. And then there's taxable land. Anything that is taxable land in the state, even within the boundaries of an Indian reservation, is not tribal land. That's county or state or city land. When the reservations were almost opened up and then they were closed up, it created what we call a checkerboard system. For example, here on the Flathead Reservation, there's several thousand acres of federal Indian trust land, but there's many more thousand acres of farm and cattle land owned by Montana citizens that are taxpaying on their land, and they're not under the government of the tribe, and the tribe has no authority over them. So there's those two kinds of lands that are created. The federal Indian trust land is, and their governments are not Republican forms. But the lands that are taxable, any property that's paying taxes to the state is under state authority or county or local authority. That's confusing for people. And the tribal governments, it didn't always used to be this way, but I'm going to say since gaming came on and they got so very wealthy, that they've become pretty aggressive. And they will attempt to govern cattlemen on their own private land. They're attempting, and they are, pulling the irrigation water off of the farmers. And there's problems. There's there isn't the really good live and let live that existed on Indian reservations for decades prior to the gambling and then prior to their ability to influence politics. It's no longer an amiable situation where it was for many, many decades. People may do, but it's a little testy now, a little tricky. Anybody else got a question?
It seems like the tribes have learned to control the committee men, just like John talks about taking back the political process.
Yes, yes.
It's very effective.
Let me give you a real horror story that Montana is putting up with. I moved to Montana from Wisconsin in 2015, and I just love the people. People here are just the hardest working, shirt off your back, great, great people, but they're very politically naive. In the middle of Montana is a very large Crow Indian reservation. It's just east of Billings, Montana, and it's big. And the Crow tribe and the ACLU sued the state of Montana for claiming that polling precincts were too far away for its Native Americans to vote. And they won. There are now 19 polling precincts within the boundaries of the Crow Indian Reservation to make it more convenient for Native Americans to vote. Here's the problem. There is no state law of any kind applicable on the Crow Reservation. The Secretary of State has no enforcement authority or election authority over those 19 polling precincts. And so what's been happening, and I was part of an organization that sued over this, but the case got tossed out by a governor who'd been funded by tribes here. What is happening is that the Crow tribe holds an annual feast. In 2005, they published a full-page ad in the Billings Gazette and said, we're taking over Bighorn County. That's the adjacent county. Full-page ad said, we're running a slate of candidates. They ran for county commissioner, for the county judge, county sheriff, county this, county that. And then they held these feasts and gave tribal members paid days off or a holiday. They bussed them into areas. They gave them a list of who to vote for. And they turned those votes in very 11th hour. And they took over Bighorn County. And that's how Senator John Tester also defeated former Senator Conrad Burns by just 1,300 votes. Those late-arriving votes from the Crow tribe were intentionally late to give Tester just what he needed to take out a Republican senator and place a Democrat senator there, and Tester happened to be the 51st senator to change the Senate from Republican to Democrat in 2006 and 2007. And that continues to this day. The polling precincts on the Crow and perhaps others, but we're certain it's the Crow, in close elections, the Crow vote comes in late and swings the vote. And what that does is they'd issue tribal enrollment cards in an Indian name, an English name, a maiden name, whatever, and jump up the vote to sway the election. And that Crow tribe and the six other tribes in the state pretty much nullify my vote and any my fellow Montanans' votes. And we cannot get the governor, the Secretary of State. We've hammered on three different secretaries of state since 2006. We cannot get the state legislature, the governor's office, the attorney general's office, the Secretary of State's office to do a single thing about it. Because they were all funded campaign contributions by these seven tribes. So the Montana citizens' vote is basically a joke out here. And nobody's willing to do anything about it, no matter how bad we all scream. And I have. I've done videos on it. We've met. We've had multiple meetings over the years. We've raised holy hell. And we can't get it changed so far. I mean, we won't quit trying, but so far. And similar things happen on reservations over in the Washington State where the tribes will vote collectively. They'll hold big feasts and have big gatherings. One tribe was giving vote their tribal voters a free TV. The Crow tribe was, when we have the council check, the Crow tribe was paying their tribal members $40 per vote, and we have the council checks on that. So when you can bulk vote with 31 tribes in one state or 7 in another state or 11 in Oregon, when you can get a bulk vote going and you can contribute financially to the candidate, that's pretty powerful stuff with only about 1.5 million Indians in the United States that are enrolled tribal members. I mean, their power is amazing combined with the gaming industry. And we're in trouble. We're really in trouble as a country on this stuff. And especially since very recently, these tribes are partnering up with some other folks that aren't fond of us from the Middle East. It worries me. It really worries me. It's a domestic issue that is not spoken of. I speak of it because I just can't be quiet. But most folks are very much afraid to even dare. They don't want to be called a racist or a bigot or whatever, you know. But I'm really, really grateful. I can add a little bit of good news. Under the Obama administration, tribal leaders were in and out. There were continuous events at the White House for tribal leaders under his administration. And he was brought here to the Crow Indian Reservation and made an honorary Crow tribal member. And Obama was just all things tribal, in addition to all things Muslim, in my opinion. Now, President Trump, I read an article on one of the Indian, lobbyist or Indian media websites, was that they're very upset with President Trump because he hasn't invited a single tribal leader into the White House yet. And that's the contrast. But I really believe that this president and his administration are paying attention to some of this stuff. I don't want them to really take it front on right now because, I mean, he's got enough in it. But perhaps with the 2020 successful re-election, we'll get some major changes in Indian policy because it's destroying the fabric. It is now placing tribal sovereign authority above state sovereign authority in a dozen states or more. And it has to be at least dramatically corrected, if not ended, as unconstitutional. And the U.S. Supreme Court is a huge help. The U.S. Supreme Court for the last 15 years has come down with really, really good Indian law rulings that are supporting state sovereign authority, that are supporting private property rights and citizen rights against this tribal aggression. The problem is those rulings were entirely ignored under Obama and previous presidents, and the Supreme Court doesn't have an enforcement authority. It can issue the rule, but if a governor or a state or a county commissioner doesn't pick up that rule and use it, it's useless. And so we're getting really excellent rulings. There's a couple coming down before June of this year that are going to tremendously solidify state sovereign authority over tribal authority. We really anticipate very positive rulings in June on two big cases, one out of Wyoming and one out of Oklahoma. But then it will be up to these states to pick up these rulings and use them and defend themselves against the spread. Oh, anyway, any other questions or comments? Am I scaring you to death?
I have a question.
Sure.
What tribe are you with?
I'm not enrolled, but I am enrollable, as are my children. I'm Cherokee, with the Cherokee tribe.
Okay, so who was instrumental in making sure or was successful in getting former President Obama paying the Indian tribe so much money.
I heard part of your question, but could you say it again, please?
Who was successful in helping or implementing President Obama paying the tribe so much money? How did that come about?
Well, it didn't start with Obama, but he expanded it greatly. It came about with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is a major component of the Department of Interior. And it has something like 3,500 employees that are managing and servicing the funds and programs of all of these tribes. And the money, Congress has incrementally increased the funding for tribal governments every year for the growing number of tribes. Obama created some new policies and secured some new funding in at least two areas that I'm aware of, but he really increased the funding in all the areas. In the area of our power grid, and in the area of facilitating funds for this relationship between Native American tribes and Middle Eastern cultures. So Obama expanded it, but he didn't start it. It started back in 1934 and has been a growing hippopotamus ever since.
But he did invite one of your members or one of the Indians to come to the White House?
Oh, many. Many tribal leaders. He held annual tribal leader symposiums and workshops and dinners. There were many occasions where tribal leaders from across the country. He had a very good rapport with the National Congress of American Indians, which I think has been around since the 1940s, and they have a big headquarters in Washington, D.C. And the National Congress of American Indians kind of sets the policy and says, oh, here's what we want all the tribes to have this year, and here's where we're going this year, and then they're in Congress all year getting it done. So, you know, the system to support the expansion of tribal governments is huge. And the voices against it are kind of silent. If you speak up and say, hey, wait a minute, you're a racist, you know. And so getting the muzzle pulled up. Well, go ahead.
Well, I'm not a fan of Obama at all. I'm aware of what he did to the Cherokee freedmen. But I want you to kind of, before I'm going to wrap this up, because I know other people may want to ask you questions, can you walk me through, you saying you have, that the tribes became citizens of the United States. So are you saying that you have dual citizenship? You're a member, you're a citizen, your tribe, you're a citizen of the United States?
Oh, thank you for asking that question. That's an important point. Enrolled tribal members do have a dual citizenship. I could be enrolled. I choose not. I'm happy being an American. I don't need to be a hyphenated American. But enrolled tribal members are citizens of their tribal government, and they are full citizens of the United States. The problem is, within their government, on their reservation, as citizens of their tribal government, they do not have civil rights, the Bill of Rights. They do not have due process. As I said, these are tribal governments that are non-Republican form. And so it's really an awkward thing to understand. But tribal members have dual citizenship, and the rest of us have our American citizenship.
So if you're in the U.S. Okay, so if you're in the United States, let's say you're traveling in your vehicle, and a United States officer, law enforcement, pulls you over and wants to give you a ticket for anything. Who has found jurisdiction? Do you take the ticket and go through the courts of the United States, or do you take that ticket and go through the courts of your tribal court? Which one?
Well, if you're speaking of a federal officer, it's best to be nice to the guy with the gun at the federal agencies. But if you're speaking of a tribal police officer, you stay polite, but he has no authority over you. You stay in your car, you don't give him your driver's license, you just politely ask him to call an officer of your government. And that can be a local county or city, the county sheriff or city police or state patrol.
but you need an officer of your American government because you're not a member of that tribe and they have no duty over you, no authority.
But if you're in the United States and let's say a police officer, let's say you stay in Nebraska, and a police officer of the United States pulls you over with a ticket.
Different story. Yeah, you pay attention to the county sheriff, the city police, the state police, and many federal agencies. They have authority over American citizens.
So they would have authority over you then.
But tribal police do not. That's the distinction. All other law enforcement do.
Okay, so that's really confusing because what you're telling me, you are a Cherokee. But you can
But I'm not an enrolled Cherokee. I'm not enrolled and they have no duty over me.
But the
does
United
that make
States
sense?
Yes, ma'am. But the United States does?
Yes. So, you know, I'm a citizen of Montana and the county I live in. And all the federal, state, and local agencies have authority over me as an American citizen. But
okay,
the tribal government does not.
Okay, you've answered it. Thank you so much for answering my question. I'm going to move
on. Well, thanks for the question. Thank you for the question. I might add one other thing that Congress did, which has been brutal and really, in my mind, devastating. The lobbyists and the Indian industry went into Congress in the 1970s and said, our people, our culture is disappearing because our children are being adopted by non-tribal foster parents. We're losing our culture. And Congress gave them the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978. The Indian Child Welfare Act, passed by Congress in 78, transferred the parental rights of enrolled tribal members to the tribal government. So enrolled tribal members have zero parental rights over their own children. The tribal government has full parental rights over all enrollable children. They don't even have to be enrolled. All enrollable children under 18 years of age. Congress, now, our Native Americans in America, they've been citizens since 1924. They're full citizens. Can you imagine if Congress passed some act that took yours or my parental rights or that of our kids or grandkids? If some state agency had, and there are cases where that's appropriate if there's a crime or some neglect or something, but to absolutely give a government parental rights of an American citizen is abominable. And Congress did that to the families that live on these reservations. And the way that works is, let's just say the tribal government is having some council meeting and making a decision, and maybe one of the tribal members disagrees with that and speaks up. They can get a knock at the door 3 days later from Tribal Child Protection Services and be told, you're a bad parent, we're taking your kids. And those kids stay gone till the parents shape up. Or just gone. I mean, the American citizens that are enrolled members on our Indian reservations have almost no rights whatsoever and really live in apprehension of the government that controls them. But they know no other way of life. The ones that do left. The ones that are still on the reservations, it's all they've known. They were born from birth. They were told to fear the white man, hate the white man. If you leave this reservation, you're not an Indian anymore. And it's a sad, sad thing. It's a heartbreaking thing. And in some cases, it gets kind of dangerous. But this is not... I took a road trip. Myself and a videographer, if you can think of the old movie Thelma and Louise, where these two wacky ladies took a road trip. Myself and a videographer took a road trip from Washington State to New York, and we drove across 17 Indian reservations, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Nebraska, up into Minnesota, all over, ultimately ending up in New York. And we would drive one day, and we would film the next, and we interviewed tribal members, cattlemen, farmers, ranchers, teachers, sheriffs. We interviewed folks that lived on that reservation and captured their stories. And they were so grateful to be heard, Nobody hears them, and certainly mainstream media won't talk about them. They were so grateful to be heard that I promised everyone that we interviewed that I would get their story in a documentary. Well, by the end of the trip in New York, I had 130 hours of film, and I couldn't possibly get everybody's story in a documentary. So the young gal, I was a medical transcriptionist, I typed really fast. So when I got back home, I took those films and I literally transcribed them verbatim. I just relived the road trip that Cammie Beal and I took in a book called Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. And that book was published in 2005. And we launched it in Washington, D.C., and every congressman that was in Congress in 2005 got the book. And many of the state legislators got their books because folks purchased them in bulk to give them out. And that book is still a big seller. You can find Going to Pieces or Slumbering Thunder, the more recent book, on any book website, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Abe's Book, Used Book, any. But that... Everything the folks were talking about that they were afraid of and concerned about in 2005, we're talking 13, 14 years ago, has absolutely accelerated and mushroomed and is far worse now. But it's an interesting read. It's not a good, I had a fellow from Connecticut send me an email and say, I've thrown this book against the wall four times. And I thought he was going to trash me. And he says, every American needs to read this book. It's a disturbing read. It was a really interesting, it was a life-changing trip for Cammie and I. I mean, we're two ladies out in, you know, boonies going across the country. It was a very adventurous trip. Changed my life, and it has me committed to my dying day to do everything I can to free the American Indians living on reservations, that they can be a full citizen like the rest of us, that they can have the, they don't have the 14th Amendment. They don't have equal protection. They don't have anything they should have had from 1924 forward. And now it's all about, you know, purchased elected officials and policy, the gaming industry, the legal industry, all the lobbyists, the money that's being made on this system for those remaining Indians, it's cruel. So I do speak out about it everywhere I can. And I, you know, and by the way, I thank you very much for allowing me to visit with you this evening. Any other questions?
Do you have a rough percentage or number for the increase in number of reservations once the gaming started from what it was prior to that?
I think in the 60s and 70s we were at 400 and some. I'd really have to go dig on that. But the best example I can think of is the fact that there were four reservations in California in 1988. We've got over 150 of them in California alone now. You know? And the most recent billion-dollar casino is in Amador County, California. That's up in the rural hills of east of Sacramento. They just opened a big multi-billion, you know, really mega casino up there for the Ion Band of Indians. And the Ion Band of Indians has one member.
Wow.
One member. Now tell me the gaming industry doesn't have just a little bit to do with all that.
You must be King of the Mountain.
I know. The word tribe implies more than one person.
Right.
You know? But one member has a big casino in Amador County now. The system is getting gamed quite well. Quite well. And the people that can make it different are the people who've received a whole lot of funding for their campaign. So one of my targets is the Federal Election Commission. We've sent packets. I worked with a land use firm out of Kansas, the state of Kansas. And that land use firm was contacted by the Trump transition team to put a matrix together of what they call low-hanging fruit, really bad regulations that could be immediately rescinded. And I was brought in to handle the Indian Policy and Environmental Protection Agency regulations and things of that nature. And so we did that matrix, and the Trump team responded with, great job, give us more. And so we have conduits. I have conduits to get significant information to the Trump staff. And we've done that with the election fraud in Montana. We've done that with the Federal Election Commission advisory opinion. That's not a law. That wasn't made by elected officials. It's an advisory opinion, and it applied to one tribe, and it's been used by all 573. I mean, we just have an inability to say no to anything tribal. And so I'm really hoping that after the 2020 election, you know, the disaster that's gone on for the president, he's been able to do amazing things against all odds. He doesn't need to pick this one up right now, but I really believe after 2020, if we can get him reelected, we can bring some relief to the tribal families, and we can get all of our lands in this country back to being the republic in form, you know? And I hope that when we start launching this and you start hearing things, and that you folks will also speak up. Anyway, any other questions? How am I doing? I've never done this before.
You're doing fine. One last question. I lived in North Stonington, Connecticut for 18 years.
Yeah.
And you know about the casino there, right?
I do. Yes. I've met the folks in Ledyard, too. Yeah.
Right. Yep. That's the other one, the Mohican tribe there, I think. But I think that the tribe in North Stonington had only 20 or less members. But that's a pretty, to me, it's a huge casino. And they bus people in from Providence and Boston and New York City and so on. You know?
Yeah.
And huge hotel, everything to go with it.
There's only two really large tribes. The Cherokee tribe and the Navajo tribe are large tribes, multi-thousand members. Most of the other tribes are very small, and yet they have, they have annual operating budgets of like $573 million for your smaller tribes, annual operating budget, and all those tribal annual operating budgets are many times more than the county operating budget that they're located in, and the county has to provide all the services. You know, so it's just upside down.
Now, is that income taxed by the federal government, or where does all that money go that the tribes take in?
We don't know, because it certainly doesn't go to the quality of life or housing or education. It doesn't go where it's supposed to go. Who knows? And they don't get audited. Their money is just sent out to them, just dispersed out to them with no auditing. All of our other state and county and, you know, everybody else goes through audit, but they don't.
You have to wonder if a lot of that doesn't go back into the group that sponsored them. Like I know in North Stonington, they always said it was Middle Eastern people that were supporting the building and the funding of it and so on.
Yeah.
Nothing in the United States even.
Yeah. And the Mohicans were working with the Malaysians, and the Mohicans and Malaysians branched out and helped put in a big casino where we fought out in Washington State across the country. The Mohican tribe and Malaysian gaming industry put in the Cowlitz Casino in La Center, Washington. I helped form a community group in La Center, and we fought that and kept it out for about 10 years, but they got it in anyway. And that's a New York tribe and internet, you know, in a Malaysian country.
Right.
Getting a game casino. So, you know, this is, you know, international. It's a mess. It's what I call McDonald's for the mob. It really has been.
So is the bulk of that support coming from the mobs from the various countries around the world?
It would not surprise me. You know, I might be using the words, the term loosely, but a lot of, you know, the Las Vegas and Atlantic City and our state casinos, our state licensed casinos, are pretty well regulated. And maybe some little shenanigans go on there now and then. But the Indian gaming casinos are another question. You know? Another question.
So, because there's very limited state enforcement.
Right. Does anyone else have any questions before we close down tonight? Pretty quiet. Well,
I
would
know.
Like to.
Maybe it was chomping. I don't know.
Well,
I'd love some people. Did I hurt anybody's feelings?
No.
Or upset anybody?
Well, you certainly painted a picture that was different than what I had imagined. It was very informative and interesting. So I want to thank you kindly for coming and talking to us this evening.
Well, I will. And I just, I have a video that was done, and I'm going to email it to you, Jen, and hope that you'll share it with others.
Okay.
That summarizes some of the things I talked about this evening and some other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to send that to you if anybody wants to follow up and learn a little more, or go to those websites and get my books. They're easy reads. And the best thing we can do is educate everybody we know. Is start saying, hey, do you know this goes on? We need to buzz it up everywhere we can.
Yep.
So thank you very much, fellas and gals.
Well, we thoroughly enjoyed it. And like you say, education is the problem. We've been fighting it for years.
Yeah. Okay, well, then I will go ahead and sign off.
Okay, Terry, you have a comment?
Nope, I was going to close it for you unless anybody has something else to say. Thank you, Elaine. We appreciate the time that you spent here. Okay, this has been the discussion group call from NLA. And did you have something, Jan?
No, I was just going to tell you to go ahead and shut it down.
Okay. This has been the discussion group call from NLA. All viewpoints, everything expressed was the that's the thoughts of the person speaking, not necessarily the views and wishes of the NLA. So thank you very much. This meeting will repeat itself next Thursday at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, and we hope you all can come back and bring your friends, and we'll see you later. Thank you very much for everyone's participation.